Everybody, hello. Welcome to the Brought to the Table podcast. This is a podcast where friends come together and they share things with each other, things that they find fun or relevant or interesting, or things that they just want to tell their friends about. We've got five people. We have me, the host, freeloader Diana Schulberg. We have Ian Walker and Carter Van Huss making up Team 1. And Team 2 will be Caitlin Phillips and Scott Pruitt. All right, so today we're actually going to decide who goes first based on a trivia question, which I'm so excited for. Okay, so everybody ready for trivia?
No, but doing it anyway. Yeah,
so are we doing this like Jeopardy? Like, you know, we buzz in with our buzzer system?
Yeah, we'll go do first hand raised then. That'll make life a little easier. So everybody ready? In the new Hobbit movies, who is the main character that they added who was not in the books? You have to say her name correctly. Ian.
Showing off nerd stuff, Toriel.
Okay, TBH. I didn't actually expect you to get that.
Are you kidding me? Ian, of course got that.
Come on.
You weren't as familiar with the new stuff.
I've literally seen all of the Hobbit movies except for the last one because, like, that's how the book happened. You don't see the last battle.
I mean, again, I knew you had seen the movies. I just didn't expect you to care.
Wow. I was gonna say Stephen Colbert.
I mean,
until you gave us the female gender, I was going to say Stephen Colbert.
I was gonna say the elf lady. So,
that's who it is.
Yeah, I would have only taken a name. Yeah. All right, so that means that Ian and Carter will go first, telling us about.
Shit, that means I got to do stuff first.
What are y'all telling us about today?
So, as I just finished a glass of it, we are actually talking about mead, the traditional honey wine. You know, everybody knows it as sort of, oh yeah, that stuff the Vikings drank because, yeah.
I'm totally not drinking a glass right now.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Anyway, so mead in and of itself is, like I said, a type of honey wine in essence. It's a mixture of honey, water, and yeast at its most basic levels, and it varies in age and flavors. Some can be done in 2 weeks. Some take as much as you age wine, so several to a decade of years. That's essentially what we're talking about.
Yeah, so mead actually has a very long history and not a very well-defined one. The earliest evidence that humans have of mead dates back to 7,000 BC in northern China, which is wild. That's so very, very old.
It's like the world's longest-running drink.
Yeah, it's up there. And I'll get to why I say it's up there and not just saying that it is in a minute. But evidence of mead in you know, that sort of era, 7,000 BC and forward, is found pretty much all over the world. Because as most people know, to brew alcohol, you need sugar. And mead is made from honey, and honey comes from bees, which are everywhere. And because bees are everywhere and honey is everywhere, mead was everywhere. So it's sort of a instance of multiple discovery or, Caitlin, I asked you what this term was. What was it? It was convergent evolution. Is that right?
Convergent evolution is what I said.
Yeah. In biology, it would be referred to as convergent evolution. But it's essentially because it's so, like, easy to accidentally make mead, it's just everywhere. Essentially, like, if you've got a pot of honey that you kind of forgot about and some water got in it, you would probably get mead. Like, that's the result. Mead. Just a big old jug of it, and then you get drunk for the first time and lose your mind because you enjoyed it. Beyond that, though, mead has been used or made all around the world for all varieties of reasons and in as many varieties as you can count. Mead, I think Ian kind of summed it up right. We all think of mead as being like a Viking or medieval thing, but really it's used or it's drunkened everywhere. There's no real rhyme or reason to how mead or how mead is prepared, what its, you know, reason is for being consumed, whether it just be for enjoyment or a ritual purpose or maybe some sort of religious ceremony or something. I would try to go through and sort of give you a summation, but you know, there's mead ranging from all the way in South Africa to all the way up in Northern Europe. It's just so much that it's not very easy to cover all of it.
I mean, it's a definition that's like intentionally vague because there's so many different types. It's literally as long as there's a type of honey as the base for sugars and yeast and water. That's about as specific as you can get with the term mead.
So I'm super curious. Why do you guys like mead so much, and why are you guys so invested in it?
I like mead so much because it's really good. And beyond just that, it's got so many varieties to it. Ian and I both have brewed mead over the years. Ian and Diana, I think, are drinking some that Ian's made right now.
So good.
I'm drinking the last batch that I made, which I think is aged about 3 years at this point. Part of the reason that I like it is because as many ways as there are to prepare wine, I would argue there's even more ways to prepare mead.
I mean, yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, for me, I definitely enjoy mead because it is a very kind of, in a way, it's a very sort of simple drink to make. But at the same time, there's a lot of sort of thought that goes into it. On other hands, like, you can just literally put all the stuff together and then forget about it for a few weeks and it's fine. But if you really get into it, it's something that you can tinker with for years with just the same recipe and learning how to, like, perfect that if you want. Or you can do things that I've done where I make like one batch every year or so that's completely different than previous things. Like, I think one of the bottles that we opened tonight was a lavender mead that I made 2 years ago.
Oh, I remember that.
And that turned out pretty well, I think. And then the other one that we have open is a blackberry and lavender mead that tastes very different. The lavender one is really a strong honey taste at first with like a lot of, I mean, not to be technical and snobbish, but like after notes of the lavender, whereas the blackberry lavender is very much a mix of berry and honey with less lavender taste to it. So like it's a very variety of flavors. And it's just fun. It's interesting to me.
I would like to throw in a counterpoint here. Mead is featured in American Gods, Neil Gaiman's book, as tasting very bad. And this is not for no reason. Mead often tastes pretty bad because a lot of commercial meads haven't been aged very long at all. So they'll still have a lot of kick left. So if you think mead tastes bad, I don't know. That's probably why. It's a common perception that I felt we needed to address.
Oh, definitely. Like, a lot of meads is, again, if you have ever had wine and you're like, oh, I can't stand wine, and then you try a different type and it's like, oh, this is great. The same thing with mead. There's so many different flavors. There's so many different styles. You'll have alcohol ranges from, like, the top, like, 14% alcohol, which is really strong. But then there is also some that are, like, 5%, which is the same thing as, like, a common cider. So like there's a huge variety, and most, like Caitlin said, most commercial meads are just kind of bad. But also to point out, with Neil Gaiman's like book, the book is done well because it doesn't necessarily say how they take the mead. I think in the show they down it like a shot, which it's a wine, essentially. You drink it like a wine, and that just gets on my nerves so much to see it done as a shot.
Yeah, so I want to sort of hit on the commercial mead thing, because in recent history, mead has sort of made a resurgence. The first sort of entry point that a lot of people sort of got to mead before it was, you know, sort of this craft thing that started popping up was Renaissance fairs. Renaissance fairs were a way to sort of provide a reason to drink mead, you know? Like, you wouldn't just go to the store and be like, oh, mead, I'll get some of that. You would go to the Renaissance fair and be like, ah, yes, let me have a horn of your finest mead, sir, please. Thank you.
One hornful. Exactly.
Yes, one hornful. And then you would, you know, you've been introduced to mead. And I can't really say that sort of is what sparked mead to sort of grow, but it definitely had a contribution, I would argue. Nowadays, though, there's a lot of craft meaderies. I know here in Richmond, there's one very near a bunch of breweries that they do an all right job. There's one up in the mountains here in Virginia as well that I like a lot. I've actually got a glass of theirs right now in my hand.
Legally up in the mountains, we should say.
Legally up in the mountains. but yeah, and to Caitlin's point about mead being not very good when it's produced commercially, I would agree. When it's produced commercially, it's not aged for very long because you can't get a lot of investors, and mead takes time. I am of the opinion that a good mead should be aged for at least 1 year, and if it's not, I probably won't like it. And you can't really just brew a product for 1 year if you don't have the monetary backing for it.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of why a lot of commercial meads fail. Or not fail, but aren't as good, at least for the first couple of years while they're putting out product, because they can't put in the amount of effort.
So when was the first time that you guys had tried mead, and what's your favorite mead been so far?
Oh boy, so I think the first time that I've actually tried mead was second year of college, was the first time that I actually was introduced to mead. It was actually a commercial like type, and I can't remember what it was called, but I think it was something like Viking's blood or something like that, you know, going off of that whole it's only a Viking drink. It wasn't the greatest, but it was my introduction to it. And then I started looking up, like, how do you do this? Like, what is mead? How do you make it? And then it's like, oh, this isn't hard to do. And I'll bring that up later whenever, you know, we discuss, like, how mead is basically done. But, like, my first batch of mead that I ever made was honestly probably the worst way to make mead, because it was literally a cleaned out milk jug that had been sanitized with a gallon of like distilled water, some honey, some baker's yeast, and some raisins, and I put a balloon with a bunch of holes on it on the top as an airlock, and that was it. It was jet fuel when it came out, but it was pretty good. And I think, like, so far my favorite one that I've had has probably been the Krampus one that we got from Blackheath in Richmond.
That was real good.
So, to answer those two same questions, probably I can't actually tell you what the first time I had mead was, but probably the first time I had mead was one of Ian's that he gave me. Ian introduced me to mead.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's okay, I guess. But I mean, there's a high probability that that is the case. Ian introduced me to homebrewing a lot of alcohols, and homebrewing mead in particular. And so that was probably one of the first times I was introduced to it. But my favorite mead, actually, I think it's the one that's in my hand right now. This is the mead that I've got the most time put into. I'm slowly running out of stock. I know of two beer-sized bottles that are in existence, one in my living room right now, and I believe one in Ian's alcohol cabinet. And then there's a bottle in my fridge right now that's more of a growler size, which I poured this out of. And that one, I think I brewed for about 3 years. Or, you know, it's been aging for about 3 years now, and so it's absolutely spectacular.
I think you're right. Mead, or Ian's mead, is definitely the first time I ever had mead.
I did want to hit one more thing about mead and, like, how it tastes. We never actually have described mead. Your basic mead, you will get a lot of honey flavor in there, which I think is something that you don't really necessarily appreciate when you're eating, like, honey on toast or something. You get a lot of sweetness and you get a lot of the honey flavor, but oftentimes
more so toast,
more so sweetness. But with mead, you can create it in such a way that the sweetness takes a backseat to the actual flavors in the mead itself, which I think is one of its best qualities as a drink.
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, that's something that can be done just by tinkering with it and, like, where you put in the flavors during the process of making it, which, I mean, I guess that'll be the next thing we flow into, so that goes really well. essentially with mead, what you're going to want to do is get a sort of vessel or a carboy, as they're called, with like the homebrewing groups. It's basically just like a glass container of different size from, you know, a gallon. I have two that are actually 5 gallon sized carboys. And you essentially will get enough water to almost completely fill that. However much honey you want, if you want more of a, like, really, really sweet mead, you're going to have, like, say, 3 to 5 pounds of honey per gallon of water. Whereas if you want a dry mead, you'll do something like 1 to 2 pounds of honey per gallon of water, somewhere in that age range. The amount of honey that you put in is also going to determine how much sugar is in there. So it's also going to play a part later on in how much the like alcohol content comes out to, in addition to the yeast that you use. Because as I found out after my first batch, there is more than just baker's yeast. There are many different strains. Some work better for different areas. Like there are champagne ones that create more of a fizz and bubble and last a little bit longer in certain areas. There's others that work better with fruits and breaking down the fruit pectin. But it's all about what sort of style of mead you're wanting to do. But those are the basics that you're going to need are honey, yeast, and distilled water. You're going to take all of that, put it in your carboy, and then you're going to put something called an airlock in it. Essentially what an airlock does is it stops anything from coming through from the outside. So you only have the yeast that you have put in there in the carboy with it. You don't want any sort of wild yeast along with it.
Yeah, so airlocks are very important. It's essentially a little tube that kind of is S-shaped that's filled with water. And fermenting anything, you know, alcohol of any variety produces a lot of carbon dioxide, and so that needs to be released in order to not put the entire vessel under pressure. Yeah, and so the airlock allows bubbles of the carbon dioxide to escape outwards through the water, but no air, which contains wild bacteria and yeast, can get back inside the vessel. So that's sort of the purpose of the airlock in a more technical sense.
Yeah, and that's really important because if you're going for a specific type, you want only what you put in there. There are some like styles of mead that are done with like wild fermenting, but those are very unpredictable about how they'll turn out, as again, different like strains of yeast will handle different alcohol contents and different flavors would be accentuated based upon what style of yeast you use. So if you're going for a specific thing, you're going to want to make sure that you use a specific type of yeast. After you start fermenting it, what you're going to basically do is you can either add in a like generic or store brand type of yeast nutrient or energizer, which you can find in pretty much any sort of home brew store. Or you can do something that works just as well and is a little bit more affordable, is adding in raisins. Honey is very good for sugar, but is very bad for nutrients, which the yeast needs those nutrients to continue. But if you add in the raisins, those provide the additional nutrients that the yeast needs. That's the basics for that. You just let it go for a while. It's going to bubble and foam and hopefully not go up and like fill out your airlock, but you let it do that and it'll settle. As it goes on, the yeast ends up dying and the yeast cells will actually collect in the bottom of it, and that's where you get a bunch of sediment and like kind of this sludgy looking thing at the bottom. You go and you do a thing called racking, which is where you siphon off all the liquid above that, and that's the clear liquid that will then go either and be bottled right then and there to, you know, start aging, or you put it in what's called a secondary fermentation, where you can add in other flavors then if you want them to be more of a stronger flavor. Or you can add flavors in at the very beginning when you throw all the yeast, whenever you pitch it. So, for example, with the blackberry lavender mead that I mentioned earlier that I made, the lavender was actually put in at the very beginning with the honey and the yeast and everything in the primary fermentation cycle. The blackberries because I wanted them to have a stronger blackberry flavor, those were actually put in during a secondary and then actually a tertiary fermentation cycle. What differentiates the different racking cycles is when you rack. A fermentation cycle occurs before and after a racking if you want to add in more flavors. But whenever you decide that you're done, you go ahead and siphon everything out, you start bottling, and if it doesn't come out to where you want it, you can actually add in a bit more honey at the very end once all the yeast is dead, and that's called back sweetening. It's a way to safely make the mead sweeter, as all of the yeast should be dead at this point. There's different ways to do that, either letting the alcohol content get too high, you can freeze it or chill it to help kill the yeast, or you can throw in, it's either Camden tablets or there's a different brand that you can actually throw in to sanitize it and kill the yeast that isn't dangerous for people to consume. And you just bottle it from there. You age it for however long you want and just drink it whenever.
Yeah, so it's a very straightforward process after you get into it. I know that, you know, all the steps that we went through there, there's a lot. There's a lot of different steps that sound very complicated, and it's really just, you know, learning over time. Ian said his first mead was Jet Fuel. I can't remember my first mead, but I can tell you it was probably Jet Fuel.
That's probably why you can't remember it.
That's fair. But yeah, and so it's something that you just sort of learn over time that, okay, instead of racking it at 4 weeks, that's too long and the fermentation has stopped and there's too much sediment, maybe I need to rack it 2 weeks because that'll allow me to have a longer secondary fermentation. And it's all about learning. I've got a notebook full of notes on how I did things, when I did them, and how it tasted at the end. And
oh, it's such a great thing to do.
Oh, absolutely.
So, other than sending in a message to our fabulous, fabulous podcast, do you have any recommendations for places for people to start, or videos, or just YouTube it, Google it? Do you guys have any recommendations for how to just get started?
To get started brewing or get started tasting mead?
Brewing.
Okay. Well, get started brewing mead is actually pretty straightforward. If you Google for it, there's a lot of recipes online for just your basic mead. And after you've sort of learned how to do a basic mead, you can expand from there. That is sort of your jumping off point. And the more you experiment, the more you learn. It's a practice by doing sort of thing. Once you get started, it's very easy to continue.
Which, yeah, I fully agree with it. I went into it not really knowing at all what I was doing. And, I mean, I'm by no means mastered it. I know how to make a basic mead off the top of my head.
His meads are really great. Would recommend. 10 out of 10.
Thank you. But, like, it's very much, like, I enjoy it because there's a lot of, not necessarily science that I understand behind it. There is science behind it, which I'm sure Carter could probably go into a lot more detail than I could. But...
No.
Come on, you're the hard science guy here.
No.
I did psychology. I'm a soft science. Anyways.
Speaking from experience, Carter is bad at chemistry.
Oh, fair enough.
Roast me harder, please. I deserve
it.
This is mead time, not, you know, not slow cooking, you know, how to do a pot roast or, like, you know.
Excuse all of you. Caitlin is clearly the only scientist here that counts.
That's true.
Okay.
I have taken a lot of chemistry courses.
But I guess, like, my suggestion would be there's a website that I ended up using, and it was called Storm the Castle. And they have a section there where they list a whole bunch of, like, recipes that people have submitted. But they also list the recipes for, like, a standard mead, as well as how to do a standard dry mead, which is, again, not as sweet and can sometimes be more alcoholic, like a higher alcohol content, or how to do what is called sweet meads, which, as the name implies, more honey, more sweeter taste, and can sometimes be a lower alcohol content. That would be my suggestion. Like Carter said, though, just Google it. It's again, it's a thing that I agree with Carter. It is something that people came up with on accident and have been just tinkering around with it for centuries. If you're anything like me and love any sort of fantasy games that has, like, any sort of alchemy in it, where it's, like, mixing potions and shit, that's what this is. No magic powers, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you can absolutely make mead with the juniper berries mixed in if you so desire. really quick here, we're running kind of long on this segment, but I do want to go over some of the like styles of mead. So like, if you hear anything you like, you can know to seek that out in, you know, whatever meadery that's nearby or restaurants that may serve it. You know, if you see it, you'll know.
We should also put it like the different types in the show notes.
Oh, absolutely. So you've got your basic yeast, or sorry, basic mead, which is just honey, water, and yeast over time. That's the long and short of it. You've got a sizer, which instead of using water as your liquid base, you use at least some part apple juice. It produces this sort of like apple cider mead that is really fun and interesting.
Which one part that I want to top off with that is the fact that if you decide to ever try a sizer, you want to make sure that like with sizers and a few of the other ones that Carter will mention, if they use if they call for a juice, you want to make sure that you're using a more natural juice that doesn't have any sort of preservatives, because the entire purpose of preservatives is to stop it from fermenting. So if you're using a juice that has preservatives in it, you're not going to get a good mead if you get a mead at all.
So some more types we've got. Melomel, those are our berry-based meads. Ian was discussing his lavender blackberry mead, which actually, if I recall correctly, you used Caitlin's lavender to make that, if I am remembering right.
There is definitely some of her lavender in there. I ended up adding a little bit more because the first time that it came out of the primary fermentation, it did not have much of a lavender flavor, and I think that was just I didn't include enough.
Highly unfortunate. Well, then moving on, metheglins are spiced meads or herbed meads. One that I made that I was really proud of, it came out really well, was a mead styled around a saison beer, actually. So it used the same type of hops as a saison would, same type of yeast as the saison would. And it was actually a very quick mead, only about 3 months, if I remember correctly. And it came out fine because it was styled after this beer, which, you know, beer is a very quick thing to brew compared to meads and wines and things like that.
Which, like, I remember you making that one. And a point that I want to bring up with, like, tying it back to what Caitlin had said earlier about how a lot of people are like, mead tastes bad, or that's a common conception. I'm not a big hops fan. Like, that's been something that's kept me away from beer for a while, although I've slowly started working into more of craft beers that are done with less hops. I do not like hops at all. This Saison-style mead that Carter made was amazing, and I really enjoyed it. So, like, again, if there's something that you're like, I'm not a big fan of this, you don't by any means have to try it, but, like, I would still just recommend of, if you think mead is bad, try different types. You never know what you might find.
Make it a mead. That'll fix it.
So there's piment, and that's spelled P-Y-M-E-N-T. Maybe piment. Maybe I'm saying that wrong. But that's essentially a wine mead, like a traditional grape wine. In the same way that a sizer was an apple cider mead, a piment or piment is a wine mead. There's a sack mead, which is a very interesting mead that's very similar to your traditional basic meads, but they're generally much stronger, generally in the alcohol content of around 14%, and then still very sweet as well. And then there's so many regional varieties of meads that I can't list here because there's just too damn many. You Google it and you will find lists of, you know, upwards of 50, I'm sure, without even hesitating. But I think that's all we've got on meads. Sorry, we've run over a little bit. I didn't expect us to have so much to say on meads. We just like the damn stuff so much.
But definitely, like, if, you know, if this is something that has sparked anybody's interest in it, by all means, go out and look for it. And, I mean, feel free to, you know, drop us a line at some point if you find a recipe that you really enjoy or a recipe that you're just sort of curious about. By no means are we any sort of experts on it, but, like, we just enjoy talking about mead, so feel free to just message us anything about it.
And you can reach us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and we also have a Gmail account, brought to the table@gmail.com. We're gonna go to a nice sweet break, but we will be back. And we're back from the break to the Brought to the Table podcast. And we have our team two, which is Caitlin and Scott, talking to us about things today. What do you guys bring to the table?
Our thing is imposter syndrome, which is pretty common. Even if you don't necessarily know what it is, you or one of your friends have probably experienced it. So, the definition of imposter syndrome is individuals who are experiencing an inability to internalize their accomplishments and who have a persistent sense of being a fraud. To elaborate on that, when you have imposter syndrome, you have an overactive inner critic, and the way that you explain events to yourself or your explanatory style has become warped. For some background, the term was coined in 1978 by clinical psychologists Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes, who wish that they had said experience instead of syndrome, because despite the name, you know, syndrome, it's not a mental illness, it's just an experience. At first, people thought that this might be a feminist issue, so early research focused on highly achieving females specifically, but it's actually pretty evenly dispersed throughout the sexes.
And to try and de-science some of that, it's like a feeling where you're either in a new place or you've been in a place for a long time, and you just feel like you don't belong. Like, everyone around you is, like, smarter than you or better than you or just, in general, more successful than you. And it's kind of a feeling that, like, even though you've done good things in the past, it wasn't because you're as good as the people around you. You're still, like, you either downplay your success or you think, like, oh, that was actually somebody else just helping me do that and I got credit for it, or I got really lucky, or I was in the right place at the right time. And it's often, like, you don't think of anybody else's success that way.
That was a good call to de-science it.
No science allowed.
I don't realize how sciencey I get when I talk about the handful of things I've actually studied. So next, I'm just going to talk about my experience with imposter syndrome really briefly. It started at about the same time as I started really feeling what it's like to be a woman in STEM fields in about fourth or fifth grade, where I found myself doing better than some boys on standardized testings, or even some girls who I just held in really high regard on either just normal tests or standardized tests. And I didn't feel like that was correct. I didn't feel like I deserved to do better than them, even though, you know, my parents and my teachers and even my friends who I had done better than could point out that I'd worked harder than them, or I'd been studying for however long, or I was always really engaged in class on the topics. But I always just had a justification to myself. Really common ones included everyone else was just having a bad day, and I was having a good day. I'm just good at standardized tests, and standardized tests are meaningless. I shouldn't actually be in these classes, and that got more common as I got older, you know, as I was doing AP courses in high school, and then in college and grad school as well, just the sense that I didn't deserve to be in the more advanced courses, and I had somehow faked or conned my way into it, and that I was a fraud who would be found out. I was not smart. I was just lucky.
So, yeah, I didn't feel like I didn't, or I don't, at least don't remember this experience like that early on, but my first real feeling of this is, like, I was applying to jobs when I was in college, and I, like, it's really hard to find a job. And so I ended up getting an internship at a financial company around where I lived. And I was like, oh man, I got really, really lucky to be here. And I only actually got here because my friend was an intern here and he referred me. So I got the interview and I got the job. And so on the first day, you're kind of surrounded by a bunch of other people. And it's really easy to see people for, like, the top bullets on their resume where everybody's like, oh, I've done this really cool thing. And it's really hard to see them for, like, that that one person who, like, screws up almost all the time. Or, not saying that people screw up all the time, but, like, it's really hard to see people's faults when you're, like, introducing yourself by your good points. It's, I think it comes for different people at like different parts in their professional career or like just in their, you know, school life or whatever.
Oh yeah, I know. The fact that I started feeling imposter syndrome as a child is definitely like extremely unusual. Kids shouldn't feel like that. But then the next thing is kind of my experience with imposter syndrome in grad school, which was basically the first time that I really found a name for this thing that I'd been experiencing my whole life. And even though I could hear other people talk about how they struggled with imposter syndrome and how their experiences currently, their current research experiences, were almost exactly mirroring mine, where especially in grad school, because it's just a very strange time in your life. It's really transitionary. You're asked to do wildly different things at wildly different levels of responsibility from one moment to the next. You know, you're sitting in like basic bio stats one second, and then the next second you're going and you're conducting your own research where you're making these decisions about what you should do and what assays you should purchase, you know, and thousands of dollars worth of things are suddenly your responsibility when just a second ago you were having some very basic statistical concepts explained to you probably for the fourth time in your life. So it's a very strange time, anyway, is my point. So it's common in grad school. So my peers generally tried to be pretty good about talking about it, because another thing is that first year master's students and like second year master's students, third year PhD students, fourth year PhD students all get grouped together and all talk about their research in the same ways at the same times. So it's very easy when you're first going in to idolize other people and really beat down on yourself.
So what I really think is interesting about this topic that you guys have brought to the table is that it really is something that happens in a lot of places where you might not expect. It happens in grad school, it happens in like younger years of schooling, it happens in all sorts of places. I know I personally have had some issues with it where I very much understand the, I did not realize this was a thing, it was a concept. I had been studying in Switzerland for a couple months with a group of people who had a very different skill set than I did. And so as we were going to get ready to go work as outreach teachers to a group of Rwandan students, I was very confused of the, why was I picked for this? Why am I here? I don't have anything to offer. I feel like I just kind of lucked into this position because they didn't look too hard at my application. And I remember explaining this to Ian at some point, who of course has a degree in psychology. He's like, you should Google imposter syndrome. It's a thing. Not everybody really knows what the name for it is, but it's definitely a thing.
I mean, like, yeah, it's a thing that I think needs to get a lot more sort of like coverage, and people need to be aware of it, because like it is something that affects a lot of people, especially like Caitlin said, where it's, you know, in upper education, and like the higher up you go in that sort of like specific sort of education that you're pursuing, the higher it seems like that is going to occur, that people are going to feel this imposter syndrome of, I don't know how I'm here, I don't know if I really deserve to be here. But like something that I think I've tried, like anytime somebody's brought it up to me, that I always try to like point out is, you're never going to see yourself in a completely unbiased light, whereas you're also never going to see anybody else in an unbiased light as well. So whenever you're like with what Caitlin was saying earlier about, you know, it's easy to idolize mentors and peers and stuff like that, you have to always keep in mind as a way to like deal with this is that you're going to see mainly only their highlights. The most that you're going to focus on is the best things that they have done, whereas you're aware of everything that you have done and any failings that you have, whether they're real or things that you have like thought of as your own failings, those are what are going to stand out to you. So you're really going to be comparing like a person's highlights to your worst of all times. So I think that's something that like needs to be brought in as well and kept in mind whenever you're like, I don't belong here, I'm nothing like anybody else, all of these other people deserve to be here much more than I do. it's not necessarily the case.
I just wanted to clarify. So my experience is definitely extremely unusual, and I also have mental illnesses. I started feeling imposter syndrome at about the same time that I started having panic attacks. So I don't want you to think, you the listener, to think that it's something that happens to children or even, you know, younger students in general, because it really shouldn't. It generally happens to people who are going from one step in their life or career to another one, especially in a sense of high achievements. So applying for college, it'll flare up a lot. Applying for grad school, it'll flare up. Applying for your first job, starting your first job, starting college, starting grad school. Those are the times when you really should be expecting to see it. Not fourth grade. That's not normal.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of hammer home some of the points there and like talk about my experience. It's like Caitlin really brought up that it's like when you're going to a new stage, but I found that it's also just like anytime you do something new, like mine was all new jobs, and even when I switched teams in my current job, like you have this like amount of knowledge you need to do your job correctly, and everybody that's sitting around you and everybody you work with already has this knowledge, and there's like this feeling that somehow, even if you think you are a capable person, you'll be unable to acquire the knowledge or unable to acquire the skills to like be competent at your job that everybody else around you has magically acquired. And I read about this in a couple of articles, and there's like a common theme that peer review is something that makes this worse, which is something I do a lot in my job in software development. Like all the code that you write is reviewed by someone else, and you are always reviewing other people's code, and you have this tendency to like see finished products from other people, or at least polished products in some way, and you don't ever see the person who's been sitting for 2 hours at their computer like, why doesn't this work, unless they actually tell you about it. And so you can be solving similar problems and you like have these internal struggles that you don't tell anybody about, and then somebody else submits this code and you look at it a couple hours later and you're like, wow, they didn't have any trouble doing this job that I just failed at miserably. And another like final point I wanted to point out is like, it really depends a lot on your surroundings, or at least it did for me. Like, when I started out, I was with a lot of new people, and like everybody's having these same struggles, like doing very basic tasks until you like ramp up on that. And that was fine. And then I got placed on a team where like everybody on the team had been at the company for at least a year, and most of the people have been in the industry for like 10 or 20 years. And so if you get paired with none of those people, it's like an incomprehensible amount of like context and knowledge that they have that you just have the feeling that you don't. And when you get in meetings with all these people, everybody is like bringing like interesting information or like coming up with solutions or brainstorming ideas. And even if you are contributing equally to that conversation, you have like this like 5-on-1 or 3-on-1 where like there's three times as many ideas that aren't your own. And it can feel like everybody else is in agreement on what a good idea is, and you've really only had the small portion of what the good idea is.
So we've talked about, you know, what imposter syndrome is. And I personally am kind of in a situation where I'm battling it right now. I 1 month ago started a new job, and it is a highly technical position that I mean, like imposter syndrome, I don't feel qualified for.
Same.
Yeah, I know that you as well have just started a new job, Ian, and so you probably will, you might have the answer to this question due to your psychology background.
Oh boy.
So my question is, as somebody who is actively going through the struggles for this, not saying I'm the only one in here, what sort of things can I do as an individual to assist with, you know, combating this internal struggle? And secondly, what can I ask of others to assist me in this?
Ways that the internet suggests to manage it is to discuss it with peers and mentors. And I know personally, when I started at my relatively new job, I've been here for about 6 months, it's not that new anymore. But, you know, 3 months ago, having honest conversations with the other early career scientists I work with, and hearing that even though, you know, they were 27, 29 to my 23 years old, they were still feeling imposter syndrome, and they knew it was imposter syndrome very confidently, helped me also dismiss what I was currently feeling as imposter syndrome. Another thing that is suggested for management is making a note of your successes when they happen. And that doesn't mean necessarily like going around and bragging to everyone, but, you know, maybe bragging to your friends or even just writing it down for later. And you can even justify that to yourself as saying, well, this is, you know, for my annual review. I want to keep track of the times when I did something and I did it well, so that later on, you know, when I'm reviewing my past year with my boss, I will remember these good moments. Another management strategy is to develop a strong support network. So like I mentioned, me and the other early career scientists have actually become a pretty good support network for each other. And it's definitely really lessened the experience of imposter syndrome for me in a way that never actually happened in grad school, because side note about academia, it's also very isolating. And something else to consider that was suggested is potentially therapy. And I do, again, want to emphasize that these are management strategies and not treatments, because it's not a mental illness. It's just an experience. And as far as what you can ask other people to do, I can't really think of anything, you know, other than just talking to people who either are where you are right now, like me and the other early career scientists, or talking to people who have been where you currently are in the past, either your mentor or someone who's just, you know, one step above you in your career.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add, like, things that have helped me. Like, I usually start when I'm, like, anxious about stuff, I usually, like, have a pretty bad tendency to just accept failure. Like, if I think I don't belong there, I'm like, yeah, I'll just be fired in a couple weeks. It's okay. Which I don't think is healthy. But the one thing that, like, legitimately helped me a lot is, like, having official one-on-one either meetings or conversations, like, scheduled time, maybe not scheduled agenda, with somebody who's, like, more senior than you, but only barely. Like, for me, it was roughly a person who was, like, had a year experience at the same place as me. Because they have a lot of context on, like, what struggles they expect you to have. And, like, them expecting you to have the struggles and them talking about them either still having them or, like, having had them in the past is, like, really, really reassuring. And they can also, like, you can give status updates and they can be like, oh, that's really cool. Like, I didn't expect to be able to do that. Or when I was, like, just a year ago trying to do this, I struggled with that too and stuff like that. So they can provide context but also give you tips on how they overcame the same struggles when they were like trying to do the same thing recently.
So yeah, I definitely agree that, like with Scott, talking with people that are either like directly above you or like somebody who's been at your job just a bit longer or you see as more senior than you, that definitely has a way of improving, you know, the issues that you have with imposter syndrome, especially if you approach it with a more sort of, hey, this is what I'm feeling. I'm having these sort of ideas of like, this is what I think I should be doing, and I feel like I'm struggling with it. Like, it's very hard, especially like in our culture, which is, you know, very Western, there is no room for failure sort of culture, for us to sort of admit that we are having difficulty. And so it's easy to just sort of like internalize it of, well, it's not because the job is hard, it's because I'm not good enough for it. Nobody else is saying that they're having trouble with it, so therefore this is only me, whenever in all actuality it could honestly be everybody else is having the same problem as you, but nobody else is saying anything about it for the exact same reasons. But I would definitely say that anything that could sort of build self-esteem would be a good starting place for this, as like a lot of what I've seen and have been taught about this topic is you have that internal critic that's very, very aware of any negative side and sometimes might even come up with ways that are negative that really don't exist. But it's still trying to build that feeling of self-esteem of, no, I might not know everything, but I do know what I know. Like, I'm good at what I do. So starting with that, you know, making a list of positive interactions or positive knowledge or affirmations about yourself is a good starting point. It's not going to solve it immediately, but it would be a good place to start and build from there.
Something else that I wanted to mention is that this is very often tied into being a perfectionist, which I definitely am. And so one of the ways that I've actually been managing both being a perfectionist and having imposter syndrome at the same time is just talking to my boss a lot. And she's not touchy-feely at all. She's very, you know, no-nonsense and straightforward. And I mean, I love her. She's the greatest. But she's not someone who I'm going to go up and be like, I'm having a bad day and I'm really feeling imposter syndrome. You know, like, she would just be like, all right, that sucks. Like, she's not the right audience for that. But if I just have these straightforward, you know, conversations with her about, well, I'm working on this, I did do this, I know I've done a good job on this, and I'm confused about this, I've been struggling, you know, with this separate topic or something like that, and just going through and breaking everything down like that so that she can both provide me that validation of like, yes, you did do this thing correctly, and oh, you did this even better than I expected you to do, as well as, okay, yeah, no, you're approaching this from the wrong direction, you should be treating it in this separate way, both really helps with my tendency to be a perfectionist, as well as imposter syndrome, because both of those things tell me to just beat my head against the wall whenever I am not immediately perfect at something. And the best way to counteract that, I found, is to just very simply, plainly, without emotion, just asking for help and clarification. So I feel like we're kind of winding down. What I want to do is throw in a few more fun facts, and then tell two brief stories about times that my imposter syndrome got like crazy, crazy, you know, out of whack. So just some other things I came across in researching this that I thought was interesting is that 70% of people will experience this at one point or another. And as I kind of touched on when I was introducing it, this is not a gendered experience. Men feel it just as often as women do. It's more common in high achievers and African Americans, especially with the whole mess of affirmative action. But since we're literally all white, I don't think we should delve into that, but I felt it was worth acknowledging. I also saw this 2016 Huffington Post article entitled Why Imposter Syndrome is Good for You, where some researchers and the author were arguing that, you know, this was just a clear sign that, you know, the experience of imposter syndrome was a clear sign that you were spending time outside of your comfort zone. And since the most growth occurs outside of your comfort zone, this is just a good metric for seeing when you're being challenged and when you're growing. But I do disagree with this.
I definitely agree with you there, Caitlin. Like, while I do understand that, yes, most of a person's growth will occur outside of comfort zone, this is, I would definitely say that this is most definitely not something that is just outside of your comfort zone. It's, I would definitely say it's not a metric for when you're challenging yourself and growing, because you can still feel like you know what you're doing whenever you are challenging yourself. It just because, like, you know what's going on doesn't mean that it's not a challenge, but I don't know. I don't know where they would have gotten that from. And, like, honestly, the psych in me is just like, I need to see this research. I got to see their methods and, like, what their sample was, because I don't know where they would have gotten that conclusion from, because it doesn't stand out to me.
So, Caitlin, did you want to finish up your story? And then, Scott, if you had any more comments?
I do. So, I had, well, many, many times in my life where imposter syndrome was bad, but I got accepted into the second best school in the country for my graduate program in what I study, and I had full tuition remission, you know, tuition was covered, as well as a modest, pretty small stipend. So, like, you know, I I did good at the whole process of getting into graduate school. But even after I graduated, you could not convince me that I belong to be there. Because the, you know, key events, as I saw it, you know, the way that I was explaining it to myself was, I had gone down for interview weekend, just by luck, happenstance, random chance, I ended up talking to the person who would later become my, my mentor, my advisor, my principal investigator, or PI. And then because we had had this nice conversation, I decided to sign up for an interview with her, even though our research fields didn't necessarily perfectly align. And she happened to have several master's students graduating and funding to allocate. And we ended up really hitting it off. And then, you know, she reviewed my application and I came down for another interview and we had a phone interview and then I was accepted. So it's something where I could take a step back and logically tell myself that I'd gone through all this work, you know, and I'd had my credentials reviewed by many people at many stages, but because it just kept coming back to there is, yeah, some element of luck to this, my brain could totally convince me that this was entirely a luck-based experience.
Cool. It's really nice to hear a lot of personal accounts. Scott, do you have any final comments on imposter syndrome?
No, I think we'll cut it there.
All right. Well, this has been another fantabulous Brought to the Table podcast. You can find us on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter. We have all of that. It's all under the name Brought to the Table, except for Twitter, which it was slightly too long. You can also email us for any questions about Mead, imposter syndrome, any suggestions. We love any kind of comments or thoughts or feelings at brought to the table@gmail.com. And so please leave a review on iTunes, subscribe, please continue with our episodes. We love listeners and we always love, you know, we always love it when somebody else wants to, you know, give a suggestion for bringing something to the table.
Yeah, please put in any sort of suggestions. Make us do less work.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.